Welcome to this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two men in the middle of the country get together and talk about politics, current events, and other fun stuff. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Kinnig.
Brandon, it's been a couple weeks since we laid a pod down. That's my fault. Again, life gets in the way of us talking from time to time. It did again the last couple weeks. I apologize for that. But in the last couple of weeks, to me, things just couldn't have gone worse for the Republicans if they tried. It seems like the Republicans have had a very challenging couple of weeks that were highlighted by this big aid package that passed last weekend. This is the aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, kind of all rolled into one. And what was interesting is that Mike Johnson's role in this. Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, he was responsible for bringing this to the floor. And he was basically told, if the Ukraine aid hits the floor, you're going to get vacated. That didn't happen after the vote. Let's just start with a little bit with, give me your overall impressions of Mike Johnson. What has he done? I mean, just tell me a little bit about the role he stepped into and what you think he can accomplish as Speaker of the House before we kind of get to what he did accomplish.
I think he was much more certain of what he thought he could accomplish initially, but as his margin continued to narrow with retirements and Santos losing his seat and others, he's down to either a two-seat or one-seat majority. Mm-hmm. It depends on the day. It's not out of the realm of possibility that something could happen to another member of the House Republican caucus and he would no longer have any majority before November. Like, you know, it could very well happen. But I think he's cognizant of that. And so I think his outlook has changed. But he's trying to find his voice. He's trying to find, you know, who he is. And as part of that, I think he's struggling to determine who he wants to be and who he wants to align himself with. There's a part of him that goes back to kind of the establishment traditional Republican guard. And, you know, before he made nice with the MAGA caucus and with the House Freedom Caucus and became aligned with them. And so I think he's trying to return to those roots in some way, you know, and so that's why when he was first elected, there was concern because of his MAGA loyalty that he was going to not be someone who could be counted on when it came to traditional foreign policy, Republican, Democrat establishment foreign policy. But other people, you know, said, you know, that's, you know, he understands the world order. He understands America's role, that he wasn't going to capitulate. But he's played those games. I mean, we've gone 6 months now since funding initially dried up. That's a long time.
Let me ask this way. When he became Speaker, did you think he had any capacity for independent thought, or he was just a complete extension of Trump in that role?
I thought he was an empty vessel, basically.
I did too.
Yeah, just an extension of Trump, and he would do whatever Trump told him. And so he's, you know, some people have said that he has vacillated enough that he's basically triangulated. I don't know if he's that clever that you would apply triangulation to his methodology and his tactics. But I think that he has come to the right decision. It took long enough. You know, he splintered this out across multiple votes, which I also found weird. But, you know, it got done, thankfully. It passed. A message was sent, finally. Funding could not happen soon enough because Russia has been making gains in the absence of Ukraine having the funding it needs for the weaponry and for the tanks. So at the very least now, they can kind of hold the ground that they have and prevent Russia from taking some of the major cities and moving further west. And, you know, and it's interesting to me, too, that this has been held up because Republicans have long, you know, tried to outdo the Democrats on Israel, that they are the pro-Israel party. Yeah. But that was also caught up with this, too, was funding for Israel. And, you know, that had not happened. And so I think that put the Republicans in a very difficult position. So they finally capitulated. It's hard to read Mike Johnson and completely understand what his goals were. I mean, he gave this very lofty speech about being a wartime speaker and, you know, standing on principle.
That's a step down from last week when he was Moses.
Right. But I don't know if it's that so much. Some of it might be legacy, that he's seriously thinking about it. There was a lot of pressure brought to bear on him. We can't forget that. outside of the MAGA faction by the White House and by Mitch McConnell on the Senate side.
Yeah.
There was that meeting where they were basically all pressuring him and they were all surrounding him, you know, saying, you got to get this done. So I don't quite know. Some of it may be like an effort mentality because, you know, he realizes that he's down to basically no majority now anyway. So no matter what he does, he's probably going to piss somebody off.
Well, I mean, let's look at Mike Johnson and examine what are his basic kind of incentives through this whole process. So he gets the speakership of the House. Ukraine support is really becoming kind of this main wedge issue for a subsection of the Republican Party.
Right.
So it's within his – he is incentivized to stretch this out as long as he can. He avoids kind of angering his a portion of his party by moving it forward. He appeases Donald Trump, or he doesn't have to bring this up to Donald Trump because we don't really know where Trump lies with some of this stuff. So he kind of keeps Trump at bay as well. And then also, if I'm thinking about negotiation, Brandon, if I know I have something you really, really want, it behooves me to make you wait for it a little bit. It creates more anticipation from you on what do I want and how do you go about getting it from me. So that part, that 6-month delay, well, I think that was disgusting and stupid and in some ways immoral and dangerous, at least from a political point. I understand that part of this game. We both have something we want. I'm in charge of this portion of it. Let's talk about how we both get something we
want. Right, but 6 months for what concessions?
This is the part. And then I have something I really want. And in Mike Johnson's case, it's the border bill. And help explain to me, Brandon, because you've been around the legislation process. Don't you try to exact the most political policy points from your opponent when you have something they really want and you have something you really want? I guess what I'm saying, if I'm one of those 113 Republicans, I think, that voted against Ukraine aid, and most of them linked the border, that, hey, we've told our people the entire time that nothing is going to happen here until we get our border secured. I understand their frustration. I mean, they look at this as, if Mike Johnson, we handed you the most leverage that really a speaker has been handed around here in a long time, and you turned it into absolutely nothing from a priorities from this section of the Republican Party. Because again, now the Democrats have gotten their main legislative priority through. That is Ukraine aid. Passed the Senate today. That aid and those weapons are flowing back to Ukraine. And in exchange for that, the Republicans have got absolutely nothing done on the border, which is their priority. And a lot of people put that at the feet of Mike Johnson.
Agreed. And I typically, like in a process like this, like there'd be a lot of there's an amendment process. And so you have the committees, both House and Senate, that would meet together to iron out compromises, and the legislation would go back and forth. It would bounce around before there would be a consensus that both sides could agree upon. And that didn't happen this time around.
And you know why that didn't happen? Because they took everything the Senate passed, Johnson did, and rolled it into those bills. That's another point of, we didn't even get a chance to put our own voice onto this. We just had to eat shit on whatever the Senate Republican or Democrats put at us. That's another reason why this is a complete fail on Mike Johnson.
Well, Mike Johnson did meet with Trump and get Trump to kind of give his blessing to Johnson, he was doing. And if you recall, Trump did make a couple of comments about the funding to Ukraine should be made in terms of like repayable loans.
Yeah.
Having Russian oligarch assets seized to pay for some of the equipment needs. So all of that was included in the final bill. So again, as kind of a nod to what Trump wanted to kind of, again, placate the MAGA crowd and placate Trump from going after him, with the hopes that, well, his MAGA supporters in the House are not going to be as vociferous. But
how I see this, if I'm the Republicans, I just cut both of my legs off for the 2024 election. Well, you can't convince me border is the biggest issue for you, right? Twice you've pooped all over that.
I think that's a very strong case to make. And I think it's something the other side can point to as say, see, like, you know, this is all politics with them. Like, the border has been about politics since the beginning, and this just proves it. I also wonder if Mike Johnson, if Marjorie Taylor Greene's motion to vacate, which happened before this was taken up based on just the budget reconciliation, you know, that was going on, if that was premature. And so that ended up backfiring because that actually sent a signal to Mike that he was willing to just be more bold than he had in the past, because he's like, if they've already put up a motion to vacate now, like, what the heck? Like, why?
Well,
calling their bluff maybe on it? I don't know.
And it's, again, if our two biggest priorities are the border and defeating and not sending money to Ukraine, in our rhetoric, we've linked those two together. Like, we shouldn't defend the borders of another country but without defending our own. That's a common kind of talk
track.
That's
a case that, yeah, that they've been making
in the House.
And you just
absolutely just – you just – what? You absolutely walked away with neither one getting any of things that you wanted out of this.
No, but the Republican caucus on the actual vote spread was split on this. A majority actually voted against it. It was a slight majority, and then you had those that voted for it. So it really did split the caucus, and it was one of those votes. It'll be interesting to see the ramifications down the line. I mean, I don't really anticipate there's going to be much legislatively that gets done. This has been a do-nothing Congress for
the
most part.
We're done
beyond this. But yeah, what ramifications is this going to have with the grassroots activists, with getting base voters out in November? I mean, it's not going to help. Will it hurt?
How big is that base? Here's a little bit maybe of some indication of that. So during the amendment process on this, Marjorie Taylor Greene put up an amendment to zero the funding out just for Ukraine. Just basically take the funding to the military, to this big package, and just line item that out. 70 Republicans voted for that. So 70 Republicans in the middle of this bill decided to cut the funding for Ukraine.
Yeah.
Who is endorsing that from a behavior standpoint? I mean, because Trump just went against Marjorie Taylor Greene when he came out and threw his weight behind Johnson. So that's another one where now you're firebrand. Somebody who is good at fundraising and messaging for you, you've cut her off at the knees too. Because when she told everybody, take the week off, go back to your constituents, hear them complain about how bad this is. When you come back, we'll get rid of Johnson. Well, that whole narrative is gone. Yeah. Because when she comes back, the first question is, obviously, Trump approved of this. Where do you stand with Trump, and where do you stand on this issue now? So even the people that are their most active fundraisers and messengers that are MAGA, I mean, we're talking Gates, Boebert, Gosar, Green, Trump is undercutting them with this aid package as well.
He is. Massey did sign on to the motion to vacate, though. So
I think there's been 8 or 9 people sign off on that motion to vacate. I mean, does Trump finally understand that he, although he only thinks of himself, he is running under a larger brand of the Republicans, and they can do damage to him? Did he finally kind of learn that lesson that there are some things that these folks can do that are going to rub off on me?
I think that's part of it. I think that, you know, and I think that's kind of why he came around. I think that's part of like his trying to moderate on abortion, even though it's not working for him, is also in that same vein that he realizes the damage it could do to the party and by default to him. And so he's adapting to that, which is not typically what he does.
Brandon, do you think Mike Johnson truly had that come to Jesus moment? Are you buying all of this that, you know, he went to this debriefing with the president and the head of the CIA and the Joint Chiefs, and new information was presented to him, and this is what opened his eyes and led to all of this activity of pushing these bills through? Do you believe any of that at all?
No, he's had similar briefings for 6 months now. Like, I mean, and he would have pushed hard 6 months ago if this was the case. So the fact that he's doing it now, again, I think part of it is legacy play for him. He, you know, he doesn't want to go down in the history books as the speaker, and the comparisons to Neville Chamberlain. There was one of the Republican House members pro-Ukraine who was made that comparison before the vote, before Johnson pushed it. So I think that comes into play. And I think part of it is just, a realization that he can't win either way with the way the majority continues to narrow. So he's just willing to be a little bit more bolder than he would be because, you know, he's in danger of a motion to vacate anyway. But I think part of it is he wants to call their bluff, because going to Trump, getting Trump's blessing, if he can hold that off and remain speaker at least through the end of the year, you know, that's a success. And I think that's what he's after at this point. He just doesn't want to have his speakership prematurely ended like McCarthy's was. And I think that he's also somewhat cocky because he thinks he can outmaneuver the House Freedom Caucus by going directly to Trump. That's what he's been doing for weeks. So is it a heartfelt position? I mean, is it? I don't think so. I think it's trying to be politically savvy and trying to prove a point that he's in control. Because you have to remember, he's been very, a lot of the rumor mill and speculation in D.C. is that he is very sensitive to the, I think, somewhat true notion out there that he is a vessel and that he has no control. And, you know, that he's in charge of a caucus that is basically pulling the purse strings and the puppet strings. So he's wanting to, you know, reset that narrative. And so this was a way to do that.
I don't know what Mike Johnson is politically, but this week has shown me he has absolutely no political savvy whatsoever. He is either just going on a balls out strategy that I don't care what happens after November of 2024, or he is truly that kind of babe in the woods persona that everybody gets to take advantage of. Here's my theory of the case for that, Brandon. So if you know you're going to knuckle to Ukraine and you know that's going to cause a firestorm in your political party and a firestorm for you, what would you do before you did that? You would try to do some things that built up a little goodwill with all the people that you knew you were going to piss off with this Ukraine issue.
And justify to the base why you do that vote. Here's what we got out of it. You know, placate them.
And get a little trust going for say, hey, I was good for you on this, this, and this. You got to trust me on this. This is the political 101 way to handle a situation like this. Before this aid package went through, the week before the FISA bill came up for renewal. This is the foreign adversary wiretapping bill. Basically allows us to basically get a wiretap on any foreign national without a warrant.
This goes back to 2002 and this the aftermath of 9/11 yes. and the war in Afghanistan.
And unlike on the old TV shows where the cops would get a wire and they would like record it on like a little cassette tape, these all go to a nice database, which has this cool web interface on it that if you've got the right credentials, anybody can now search these hours and hours of collected conversation amongst foreign nationals. And the FBI, the CIA, and God knows who else just takes free run at this database, searching for foreign nationals, American nationals. One guy testified they caught an NSA guy searching like people he was dating, people he was meeting online. This database has been abused multiple times. This has been a hot issue for Trump, hot issue for Republicans. This gets to Carter Page and all of that Russian collusion stuff that Trump is just injected into the DNA of the Republican Party. And the big ask for Republicans is fairly reasonable. If you're going to search that for an American citizen, you should get a warrant to do so. Is that something, Brandon, that you think is out of line for something that is sold as a very time-sensitive source of information that American people will die if we have to go through the process of getting a warrant? Or do you think that's somewhat... To me, that doesn't sound completely unreasonable.
No, and I think there's a way you could fast track the warrants as well. Like you can, I mean, institute a process to where it gets fast tracked to a docket where it is ruled upon immediately so that you, especially for something that's time sensitive, it is a complete reversal in positioning for Republicans who, again, going back to 2001, 2002, were more than ready to pass anything and everything along those lines. And it was Democrats who were the privacy rights activists who were not very supportive of some of those measures.
So that passed without any provisions for warrants. They tried to say, hey, if anybody's going to search it for any American, you need a warrant. When that was going down, they tried to say, okay, if you're going to search it for a member of the federal government, You have to get a warrant for that. That got shot down. So that bill was signed, I think, last week out of the Senate, signed by Biden already. FISA exists again for another 2 years with absolutely no changes to it at all.
And I was surprised that didn't get as much attention. That's as a news story. That seemed to kind of fly under the radar.
It did. And I think, again, that's on Johnson.
Yeah.
You got to know that, hey, people are going to start linking this with the security package bills that are coming as all, and the border is one big national security issue, and they're going to blame you for all of it. So if Johnson had a little bit more political savvy about him, he could have fought for something that he could have sold down the line with the FISA package. And he just didn't do that.
Yeah, he's not in that mold and mindset. And I think you have to remember that this was a job that very few people in the House caucus wanted. You know, so Mike Johnson was a choice on, what was it, the third or fourth ballot? I mean, if you go back to the rounds of voting after McCarthy.
They went through Jim Jordan, Steve Scalise, Tom Emmert. I think he was the fourth or fifth.
Yeah. So, again, you know, at that point, it's not like the most savvy strategists that are, you know, gunning for it. I mean, they needed somebody in that seat, and so that's who they went with.
But then there's indications that he does know what he's doing, because you take the TikTok bill, because they passed the TikTok bill.
That was included as well, yeah.
And you package that up. That's an example of them using leverage to your advantage.
But that is interesting for another reason, because it also goes against Trump, a reversal for Trump on that issue. And it neutralizes that issue, which Trump and his campaign, I think, wanted to be able to use, especially in this play that they had in their minds to go after young voters, you know, who would be disenchanted with Democrats supporting that.
Have you been tracking anybody's flip on the TikTok issue, like Trump's or any of the media's flip on this?
I mean, I've tracked Trump's. There's been several members of Congress that have flipped on it, too. So it's been hard to keep up.
I mean, they're trying to play a First Amendment angle, a free speech angle. A lot of them just play, you know, this would be something that Biden would tout. I mean, it is amazing how people have twisted themselves around
to
include that TikTok ban, who were very anti-China and very, you know, this has to go.
And the bill says that that ByteDance, which is a parent company, must sell to an American-held firm. Sell TikTok to American-held firm. Is it by the end of this year or is it next year?
I think it's in 11 months.
11 months. Okay, yeah. So it's like a year. Okay.
I can just jump to the end for everybody. What's going to happen with TikTok? First, there's going to be a lawsuit. They're going to sue to see if they can do this or not or whatever. And while that lawsuit's going on, somebody that is friendly, let's say, to maybe conservative politics is going to step in and they're going to buy it at pennies on the dollar. And some rich a-hole is just going to be a bigger rich a-hole with TikTok. Yeah.
Steve Mnuchin.
That's the a-hole I'm suggested he basing would buy it. This off. The
former Treasury Secretary.
Hey, guys,
for Trump.
I mean, if you want, I'll do you a real favor, a real solid, and buy this thing that's real valuable for nothing if you really want me to. That's what's going to happen with TikTok. Somebody's going to get it for nothing, who already has money, and make just a shit ton of money more. Ugh. Do you believe in political conversion? Before we switch topics, do you believe that, you know, that this can happen?
I still do, but I'm much more cynical because it happens so very rarely, I think, today. It's like trying to find a needle in a haystack. It can happen, but in practicality and reality, does it happen often? Not at all.
To your point, too, could this happen to somebody who is – he's been in the U.S. Congress for, what, 6 years? Eight years?
A while.
This was not his first briefing. I mean,
no.
I just don't. I think again.
And it was just one briefing, like right at now, that somehow changed it for him. Like, come on.
And Brandon, are we moving forward with Republicans that no Republican shall ever rely on any Democrat for votes to pass anything? Is that the new version of the Hastert rule?
Yeah, it makes me wonder. And again, you know what this does too? Again, it makes Democrats look like the adults in the room
because
he had to pass it with their support, and it shows that his own caucus is dysfunctional. He has to go to the other side. If you recall, the Democrats had to vote for something in the Rules Committee to be able to proceed, and typically the opposition party never cast a vote with the other side in the Rules Committee for something like this. So Democrats had to give up precedent to even help this.
Yeah.
over the line. So it definitely makes the other side look good. And again, I don't want to cast aspersions on this because he came to the right position. Like,
yeah.
Personally, I'm very happy this passed, and I think it'll do a lot of good. But the strategy was that there, I really don't know what's in his head and what he's thinking in terms of long term. And you have to wonder what this is going to do. I mean, heading right into an election, I think this has the potential to really put a damper on the activist base. And, you know, there could be ramifications, especially in specific congressional races.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm tired of talking about Mike Johnson. I just didn't see this coming. I mean, it's obvious that somebody told him that, hey, you're going to be out of here on a very short timeline. And he just made the power calculation to work with the Democrats.
Yeah. And again, I think there's a power play where he can kind of snub the Marjorie Taylor Greens and just, you know, basically say, I'm the one who's actually in charge. It's not you, despite what the media has said now for, you know, many months. But so that might play into it. It's, again, recasting the narrative, trying to be sly. It's hard to, I think there's probably multiple motivations at play.
So the rumor is this week that, so Schumer basically told him, hey, with the shit you guys pulled with Lankford and that immigration bill, we're not going to vote on anything immigration, just not going to happen. We don't trust you enough. You know, it just makes no sense for us to get involved. The rumor is that Johnson went to Biden this week, and while Congress is out of session this week, he is working on a series of executive orders with Biden that they would announce together and take action on the border.
Interesting. I knew that Biden was already working on some executive orders, yes. that this was already underway. I did not know Johnson was involved.
The rumor is that Biden, because the border has died down a little bit, he wanted to wait until there was an obvious visual crisis of more people crossing before he did this. But the rumor is Johnson went to him and said, hey, if we can do it quicker, I can add some stuff to it, and we can make these appear bipartisan.
Interesting.
Now, that's a balls-out move.
That is, yeah. I mean, that's, and again, something I completely would not have anticipated.
No.
Even a couple weeks ago. That's,
I mean, I don't know who, thinking back historically through speakers of the House, that's a bold play right there.
And how will, like, far-right media, react to this?
He'd get crucified.
He's going to, yeah.
I thought that.
He's going to work with the Democrat, because nothing Biden could do on the border would be trusted. You know, you can't trust Biden on the border, but yet you're going to work with him?
The theory of the case is he would bring these executive orders back to the House, and they would try to fashion them into some law. But that requires too much process and maturity and thinking. They're not going to do that.
And it's still, regardless of whether it's obvious or not, you know, intentional or not, what happens is Biden ends up getting credit for being part of the solution, which the MAGA contingent this whole time didn't. That was the whole point of not passing the Senate bill, was because they didn't want something that Biden could sign and get credit for on the campaign trail. So even working with him on a series of executive orders, like, it allows him to reclaim the issue and say, hey, I'm actually doing something about this.
And does he call Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz, Gosart, Biggs, the Freedom Caucus crazy bunch in on Monday and just say, hey, take your shot, see what happens?
He's calling their bluff.
Yeah. I thought Ro Khanna was on CNN on the Sunday show, and he already said, yeah, I'd vote to save Mike Johnson. He's like, I'm pretty sure there's a bunch of other Democrats would do it too. It'd be interesting seeing their reaction to that.
Yeah, that would be. And so I think that's part of the calculus as well, because Johnson knows he's safe. I mean, he could have a huge block. I mean, if all of the MAGA House members vote against him, but if he has the Democrats aligned with him, for the most part, other than a few holdouts, combined with the Republican establishment types that are left in the House, like, he has a comfortable majority. Yeah.
Have you seen Trump do my favorite old man move at his trial, where he prints a bunch of articles off from the web?
Oh, I saw
that. Carries them out and, like, reads to people the headlines about, here's another one from, like, the New York
Times.
Was
that last week he did that?
I think he did it again today.
Okay.
He's done it a couple of times.
I saw when he did that last week before the trial started during jury selection, and he walked out. And I kept thinking, like, look at how many, like, trees, like, you cut down. Because it's, like, full color articles, too, like, color photos. And he's just reading the.
Just hundreds of pages of them.
And let's be honest, most of these are not articles. Are like opinion pieces, commentary from his favorite pro-Trump publications. And I'm like, really, you're doing this? And it just went on and on. I'm like, this, who are you trying to persuade at this point?
When you start printing things off the internet, you're old. There's just no way. There's just no way, around it. What are your thoughts on the first 3 or 4 days of this trial? Just, it's been kind of bizarre just watching Trump's behavior during this trial. But what's your thumbnail impressions of Trump at this trial?
Well, I first want to back up and say that the jury selections surprisingly happened quicker than I thought it would. I thought that would really be a sticking point, and that, you know, Trump's attorneys would do everything possible to drag that part out and to invalidate jurors. And I mean, it looks like, based on the profiles of who they got, like, I mean, it seems like a lot of fair-minded, reasonable people. There were two that actually ended up withdrawing, you know, for due to fears, concerns about their identities becoming public.
Yeah.
And that's why – and then the judge very – well, and I think it was the prosecutors who requested and the judge approved that they weren't going to share the names with
– Yeah. Everybody's juror two.
Yeah.
There's some basic biographical data, but that's it.
But I thought that the defense wanted – or wanted to be able to share the names with Trump or with other people.
I'm sure they wanted to share them with Trump.
And the judge is like, yeah, we're not going to let that happen. We can't have these jurors harassed.
We've already had problems with Trump signaling to jurors and trying to grunt at them and things like that, of intimidation.
And think, Craig, like, if that were you or I, like, in that position, no, I would not want my name public.
No.
I mean, can you imagine
Brandon, what would you do to get off that jury? There's no way.
Oh, yeah. Everything possible. I mean, the harassment, the security threats, and these are, like, again, mostly average people. Like, they can't afford to hire security like Mitt Romney at $5,000 a day.
No.
Like, for, you know, just like.
So Andrew McCarthy explained to me why the jury selection went so fast. So he said that there's two ways to select a jury. One a judge likes, one a lawyer likes. Mm-hmm. What the lawyers like is you take all 300 people in the pool, you give them to the survey all at the same time, and you view them all in one big, gigantic block. That way, lawyers like that because you know, hey, this guy at the beginning of this process may look really good, but I know 100 people down the road, I've got somebody else. So it allows you to use your challenges more effective because you can see the entire jury field at one time. That takes longer because you have to deal with the whole pool as one big block. Judges don't like that.
Yeah.
Judges like bringing people in 50, 60 at a time, and you deal with them in that block. So if you use one of your challenges, because everybody gets like 10 challenges that you don't have to really explain, just, I don't like the looks of this person, we're getting rid of him. What you're doing is you're using that in a much smaller frame. So now you're only looking at 90 people, not the entire jury pool.
Ah, okay.
And that's a much faster process to get there. I was amazed that I think there were two lawyers on this jury.
Yeah.
There's a person who was a natural born citizen of Ireland who became a U.S. citizen.
I didn't know that.
That's weird, kind of, I guess.
And so it's very unusual, highly unusual for attorneys to ever sit on juries. I did read something, though, that there was a something passed specifically in Manhattan where there was a judge who was instrumental in getting the rules changed to allow attorneys to sit on juries. So that's kind of a facet of just the Manhattan judicial system.
Gotcha.
Specifically. That isn't the case nationwide, so kind of unique. Their rules and procedures allowing it. But it's an interesting cross-section of people that are on the jury.
And I think 3 days into the trial, we finally know the federal crime in this, which is conspiracy to commit election fraud, I think, is what they said.
Right.
The actual federal crime has been a mystery in this trial.
Right. And so, and what the prosecution is saying is, you know, regardless of whether or not it was successful, like if the intent is there, that's what you have to look at, is the intent. And they're going to try to prove that with the recordings, some of which we've heard before, but there's going to be more of that played this time. You have Michael Cohen's testimony, who the defense is going to try to strike down as unreliable. There's going to be a lot at play here.
I've given liberals this advice before, but find somebody on the legal side that's a conservative that you can kind of tie yourself to during these legal things that gives you a different perspective. Mine is Andrew McCarthy. He was a prosecutor for Southern District of New York, federal prosecutor, all of that stuff. The other day he was doing his podcast, The McCarthy Report, with another guy who's a lawyer. And you can just, as he's describing this case, you can just hear the bile and the venom just dripping out of him. Because he's like, as a lawyer, there's nothing about this case that I don't absolutely hate. He's like, I would, most lawyers, these are the types of things that when they do, they would absolutely burn the criminal justice system down to stop. And as he's going through this, the case, the other lawyer who's the host of the show raises his hand and says, okay, I mean, I get all the stuff you're complaining about the law, that again, this was like 4 years past the statute of limitations and it got re-brought up. This idea of linking one case to the other and all of those things. I get that. But he's like, just listening to the evidence, he's going to get convicted. And McCarthy was like, oh yeah, there's not a shot in hell. Because once the jury hears the narrative of this and hears it from people like the guy Pecker, who runs the National Enquirer, Karen McDougal, the Playboy model, Stormy, there's like the narrative of this, people are going to go, oh, it's point A, point B, and C. Yep, I get that. He's like, there's absolutely no way that Trump is not going to get convicted on this, but there's a high, high probability this conviction is going to get thrown out on appeal. As the whole theory of how you link these two crimes together, it's probably not going to survive the appellate process.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's very clear cut. So it then becomes a question of I'll admit I'm not as deep into it as I'd like to, because I don't know if they're going to consider.
You're not missing anything, Brandon.
If they're going to consider reduced charges as well as the full felony counts.
I don't know.
Which would dictate whether or not he serves any time in jail versus some. I mean, even if he has to serve like a day in jail, like that's very politically damaging in a way that I don't think a few other things would be.
I mean, David Pecker was on the stand to say, on the stand today, and he said, absolutely, there were stories about Trump that people came to me. I asked Trump, you know, hey, this is what's happening. I would ask the person bringing the story, are you going to sell this to somebody else? If they said yes, I would go to Trump. He would approve it, and we'd buy that story. The story of his doorman who claimed Trump knocked up one of his domestic help. David Pecker testified today that the most important question I asked that guy is, are you going to take this somewhere else and try to peddle it? As soon as he said yes, so it was confirmed that this story was going to get out, catch and kill or kill and catch went into effect. He paid the guy, killed the story. So the elements of this are all there. It's just, do they add up to a crime?
Yeah.
But just getting 12 ordinary people, they're going to be able to kind of piece this together. The appellate court might take an absolute machete to this decision.
Yeah, we'll see. Again, because in some ways it's a very unorthodox case. I mean, the closest example we have to this is John Edwards with the campaign finance violations with his mistress.
He went to jail for like 8 months too, didn't he?
He did, but he was acquitted. He ultimately was
I thought he got convicted and then maybe on appeal it got
overturned.
I think
on appeal it got overturned, but he was convicted initially. Yeah. You're right. He did serve some time in jail, so that did happen. But that's the closest case to this, because these types of cases were so rare and so rarely prosecuted. But I think it's, in light of like the stronger cases, it's kind of interesting to me, although I kind of thought, was it early last year when we speculated on all of these legal conundrums Trump was facing, which one would come first? I mean, this was the one that seemed like it would come to fruition first, although then my mind kind of changed with documents case, although that was before the judge
got appointed to that.
Yeah. So this is where we're at. Now, it'll be interesting as well. I also find it it's hard. I can't feel sympathetic for Trump, but it's interesting, like wanting to attend his son's graduation, like denied,
please.
like all of these, things, like he's realizing he's not in control and in charge anymore.
Well, I think this is why Trump doesn't want any of these trials to hit during the campaign season. This puts Trump in the one situation he doesn't want to be, sitting alone and quiet in a room that he has no control over what's happening.
Nope. And he can't talk. He can't speak his mind. There's another gag order in place as well. So, there's that.
So help me out. This gag order really is, don't threaten the judge's family, the clerks, the other lawyers, or any witnesses. Other than that, knock yourself out.
Because he's talked about all of them at length already. Yeah.
I mean, what else does, Do you really think that judge will violate his gag order and do anything other than fine him?
You know what? I would like to see some judge do that at some point and step up, because Trump intentionally defies these orders again and again and again, and like just dares judges to put him in jail.
He sent out a fundraiser last night that said, "I'll probably be going to jail tomorrow."
I mean, I think he wants to. He wants to play the martyr, yeah. And so part of it is he wants that. But I think it's unlikely. Part of me wishes it would happen, though, to send a message, because this is a guy who's evaded accountability his entire life.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this trial strips him of his energy, strips him of his presence with people, the real things that he's going to rely on to campaign. Yeah. He has no money. There's going to be no sophisticated strategy. This is, again, going to be Trump's personality is what he's going to campaign on. We're just going to see if he can do it now from courthouse steps. I don't think he's going to be able to launch a successful campaign for president, even against Joe Biden, if the majority of his campaign season is going to be stumbling out of court with a printed off shit from Fox News.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Bitching
either.
About the media.
That will take its toll in time. And I think that will depress, again, the question is how many, but in a close election, even a tiny fraction, a couple percentage points of your base being depressed and not being as energetic to vote for you, being a little bit more like, if I get out, I get out to vote. If not, you know. That can make an impact in a very close race
and
on
I mean,
the margins.
I get it why Trump doesn't want to go through this, because he just looks like dog shit. He looks terrible.
He looks awful. He fell asleep the first day as well.
Apparently he farts in court a lot.
I heard that, yeah.
And apparently the judge told him, this room can be ice cold or burning hot. What do you want? There is no, you're not going to be comfortable in this room.
Yeah.
Because Trump's been bitching, it's too cold in there. That's why he's falling asleep. They're doing that on purpose to make him look bad.
Oh,
the sketch
gosh.
Artist doesn't like him, makes him look too ugly. You know, after today, it's probably my lawyers are morons. Nobody
what
knows
would you
what
expect
they're doing.
From an image obsessed person? Oh, that because he is image obsessed more than anybody.
And when he stumbles out of that room at the end of the day, where his eyes look like they each weigh like 4 pounds, and you can see the orange, you know, mask line of his makeup and his hair's all messed. I mean, how much more is Trump? I really think part of the Dem strategy is let's see if we can break him.
Wear him down.
Let's see if we can push him to a point where he just has a complete psychotic meltdown on camera.
Oh my gosh, can you imagine if that does get to that point, which is out of the realm of possibility, he has some kind of like mental break that
it'd
is
be
captured.
A banger. It'd be a banger. We were talking too about just how the Republicans can't seem to catch a break. They're doing a lot of this, most of this they're doing to themselves. But, for example, the Arizona Supreme Court is not doing the Republicans any favors at all.
So right before the Arizona Supreme Court decision came down, Trump intended to put the abortion issue at rest by coming out and giving this speech where he was basically advocating for it to be left to the states, came out against a nationwide ban, said that what works for one state is going to work for another, said that we can find a consensus on abortion, clearly not realizing that that issue you're not going to have consensus on, strongly held beliefs on both sides. And then literally right after that, the Arizona Supreme Court was like, hold my beer, and boom, you want the states to decide it? Here you go.
Can you explain to me, Governor Ducey passed a 15-week, I think, abortion law or something before he left office, before Katie Hobbs got
in. He did. So as I understand it, by the way, again, the inner political nerd in me, this gives me flashbacks to the Brexit vote in Britain with David Cameron deciding to put a referendum on the ballot for Brexit to basically continue Tory support majority, which ended up backfiring. So in a similar vein, Governor Ducey introduced a 15-week ban. He couldn't get the far right and hard right pro-life activists in the Arizona legislature to support it. So to get their support, he basically said, hey, if I pass this, we'll let it go to the court and let them have the final say mm-hmm. to uphold it. So that was the deal that he struck to get that through the legislature with Republican support. And it went to the court, and the court said, oh, but you know, now in the wake of Dobbs, we have to go back to this law because this is what we had on the book before Dobbs. So essentially, if he...
Why? Why did they do that? That seems to make no sense.
It was a horrible strategy. And again, he was trying to just get the votes to approve it, to basically to put the issue at bay in Arizona for his party and say 15-week ban, be done with it, not touch it again, because the far right wanted a 6-week ban. So this was the compromise. How do you get the far right on board with 15-week? Say you're going to let it go to the court, and they would have the final say. And I think the thinking was that the court would uphold it. They did not.
They did not.
So, surprise, they go back to this 1864 law that dates back to when Arizona was a territory, because people forget Arizona was one of the last two states to enter the Union.
This is what drives me nuts about judges. They did that, what, because there were some words written down that said you had to use – that's ridiculous.
This territorial ban wasn't even – voter supported.
That's like what I'm saying.
It was passed by people who were unelected, who were put in charge of the territory.
But they'll point to two sentences written in 18 whatever and say, I can't. That's what drives me nuts.
There is, I think the only exception that exists in this ban is life of the mother. There's no exception for health. There's no exception for rape. There's no incest, any of the typical exceptions. It also allows for prosecutions and jailing of doctors who perform abortions. It's probably the most heavy-handed law out there. And ironically, this isn't a law that's taking an effect in Wyoming or Alabama. It's in Arizona, a swing state that continues to turn more and more blue. Yeah. Arizona has a Democratic governor, a Democratic secretary of state, Democratic attorney general, two Democratic senators, all in the age of Trump because of the MAGA pushing suburbanites towards the Democrats. So this can't come at a worse time. Immediately, pro-choice groups started getting petitions signed to get abortion on the ballot to protect the right to abortion. They got enough petitions. It'll be on the ballot in November. And it's also interesting that the other side, the anti-abortion side, attempted to do the same. They could not get the number of petitions to qualify for ballot access. So this is going to be front and center on the ballot in November, top of issue if you're voting in Arizona in terms of on voters' minds. Carrie Lake now has basically come out against it. But as recently as 2022, I mean, she was captured on video and audio supporting.
I mean, Carrie Lake is pro-choice by Democrat definition now.
Yeah.
I mean,
but that's not where she was just a few years ago.
So I don't know what she could be whatever she wants to be. Whatever's going to get her a vote.
But the good thing is, I mean, Democrats have the clips from just a few years ago that they can use against her where she was on the other side of this. This should help Gallego's campaign immensely. He's already been leading in the polls, you know, at a very good clip. And so that'll likely widen. And if anything, you know, hopefully there'll be tailwinds for Biden as well, who needs to win Arizona again as part of this strategy.
This is another case where I think you're just limited by Trump's lack of intelligence. I don't think Trump understands that pro-life is not one monolithic block. And I don't think he understands telling people, well, Roe versus Wade is gone, ends the...
Be happy with it, yeah.
And yeah, everybody should be happy about that.
There's a spectrum when it comes to abortion.
And I don't think he gets that.
No, because you have people on the very fringe of the pro-life side who will not accept anything other than a total ban on abortion. That's where they are. And they view things like having to go back to the states as a compromise, a moral compromise they can't live with. And so, you know, they don't have what I would call mushy middle positions like I do on it. Like, they're not there. Yeah. And so they don't see that. So, yeah, I mean, it's a bind for Republicans because the issue is not put at bay. It's front and center in Arizona. It's going to be on the ballot in a referendum in Florida. And it's not expected Biden will win Florida. But if Republicans...
He's in Florida today campaigning.
But see, this is the smart thing. If he can force Republicans to spend money there...
Absolutely.
Florida does have a Senate race, and it's possible that Senate race could get closer because you have Rick Scott, who's up, and he's running against a woman, Debbie Mercastle Powell, who used to be a former congresswoman from Miami, Democrat congresswoman. So he has an opponent who's a woman, Democrat, pro-choice, at a time when this is going to be on the ballot in Florida. Polling shows that and it has to reach 60% in Florida because there's that 60% requirement. But polling shows it has that level of support. So it can impact the Senate race. So you force Republicans to divert money into the Senate race, possibly even presidential race. And again, there's not an unlimited amount of money, especially when Republicans are behind in fundraising to a very great degree behind Biden and the DNC.
Yeah, they don't have the cash to go on a big, giant pro-life advertising
blitz. They can't do it,
I think what pro-life people are kind of learning, and I've heard this phrase said a couple times now, took 54 years to repeal Roe, might take another 54 years to get that federal abortion ban you're wanting.
Yeah. I mean, this is an example. What's the phrase, the dog caught the bone?
Dog caught the car?
Caught the car. That's, yeah. Sorry.
I mean, you're at the starting line now. You've got a bunch of work to do to get to where you want it to be, and public sentiment is not in your favor.
And Craig, I don't know if you follow the national polling on abortion throughout the years, but I've always been leery of people that claim Americans like one way or the other, because Americans have always been like on a spectrum when it comes to abortion.
Sure.
You've had fringe positions on either side that unrestricted, unregulated access to abortion, those that want full bans, and then most of America, which falls somewhat in the middle, some restrictions, but mostly legal. Well, those opinions have completely shifted in the wake of Dobbs now. You have more Americans that support more legalized abortion, less restrictions than ever before because of what has happened at the state level in so many of these states where they've gone for 6-week bans or no exceptions for life, health, rape, incest. And so that is turning people who were once maybe slightly to the right on abortion, more in the middle or slightly left. And so Republicans would be wise to pay attention to that because that's a sea change in opinion on the issue. I mean, it's almost like the opinion on gay marriage changing among Americans. And so you can't continue to thumb your nose like the Arizona legislature did recently, where they basically voted down the ability to fix this and clapped about it.
And applaud about it.
And get this, the Arizona legislature, they don't have a super majority. Both houses, 2-vote majority for Republicans in both houses. Easily, both of those houses will be under Democratic control after November. That's going to happen.
I think, too, that the American people are baseline uncomfortable when they feel a right has been taken away from them.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people get energized about the abortion issue, where maybe abortion isn't the key element. It's, hey, I'm not going to support, or I want to send a message to folks that you can't just be changing laws and rights that have been on the books for over 50 years.
Right. That's what we're talking about.
1976, 50 years. Got to really give thought about that before you do that again.
And so it will be ironic because this could all come down. Biden winning a second term could all be due to the Dobbs decision at the end of the day, if it happens.
And anything we could do to expose how weird Republicans are right now with women, birth control, and any real women's issues, we need to lean into that as hard as we can.
Absolutely.
Because Republicans are just in this cycle where you know somebody is going to pop off about we need a national ban on birth control as well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's coming, and people are just...
Well, and they can't find their footing. They can't speak on it. It comes off as clumsy, indecipherable. It's not coherent. Like, they can't have a unified message on it because of where the far right flank of their party is. And so that leaves them in these positions where they are, you know, trying to modify change left and right, but it just comes off as not sincere.
I mean, I can help every Republican running for office right here. Hey, what do you think about birth control? It's none of my business. It's a personal choice. It's up to the woman. Next question. And you should never answer anymore.
Well, and birth control isn't even one of those issues like abortion where there's a spectrum of opinion or it's more muddled. Like birth control, you're talking about like 89-92% of Americans support it.
Yeah.
So once you start going on that fringe, and all it takes is to have, and these people exist, these wackadoodle state lawmakers here and there, you know, and they introduce a bill, it gets coverage, and it's like, well, here's the logical where this goes. Not unlike what the Alabama Supreme Court did recently.
Yeah, with IVF.
IVF. And again, that's a position that most Americans support, access to IVF, and here's a right being taken away. And it's easy for Democrats to say, this is what happens with the Dobbs decision. It's only going to get worse. It's going to continue.
So when we first started back up the pod, I said Trump had a 51% chance of winning and Biden was incapable of closing a gap. I still directionally believe that. I think Trump's odds of winning now are down to 50.75. He's lost a quarter point since Biden. Let's just go back to the State of the Union. Biden's been on a pretty decent run. And by that, I mean, he hasn't fallen down. He hasn't had a Mitch McConnell mini stroke while giving a press conference. Right. And he's generally been able to avoid the mistake. If he can keep that up for another 6 to 7 months, which I don't believe he can, I think he can close the gap and win. Because the Republicans have shown this last 2 weeks, they are just bound and determined to set themselves on fire. And there's no way you're going to stop them from doing it.
No. I think the way to phrase it, too, is like I think this Biden is not winning the election. Trump is losing it.
Correct.
That's essentially what's happening here. And so by default, Biden can come out on top because the Republicans keep shooting themselves over and over again.
I mean, last 2 weeks, Biden's clearly won. He's gone to Delaware, to Philly a few times, which is an easy trip for him. That's what he likes to do. For every
and it's
week,
a contrast at the time when Trump can't travel to those places either.
And just every time he gets on camera, just looks god-awful.
And the national polling marginally has started to change for Biden and positively. So that is happening.
You're in Vegas over the weekend. Did you get to go to my restaurant recommendation, Best Friend?
No, I did not make it over there.
Okay.
It's on my list for next time. I did not forget. I just didn't have time when all was said and done, especially when coordinating with other people.
Yeah,
it's always tough.
You had a group of folks and everyone's trying to navigate. Are we gambling? Are we going to
a
show?
Are we eating? Who's eating where? Yeah, I'm trying to get everybody on the same page, which is always tough. And I think next time I'm going to go in at least a day or two before on my own so I can do stuff on my own and not have to be.
So are you a natural leader of that group or are you the follower? And just say, I don't want to get involved when everybody thinks I'm easy. Just let me go. Or do you try to say, hey, guys, let me steer the group a little bit?
In group settings like that, I try to lead initially. If I can't find consensus, then I quickly become disillusioned and kind of give up, and I just become impatient because I don't have the patience.
Brandon, you and my wife would be the most perfect travel couple known to man because you would just, we're on point. We're going to get this done. This is what this is. We don't care about it. You know, we're going to be on time. We're going to go. Jody just, I've
same
said
mentality.
Before, planning the trip is more important, is more fun for her than going on the trip.
Just have a plan and stick to it, yeah.
So do you like Vegas? Is Vegas a more common vacation site for you?
I like Vegas a lot for weekend trips, yeah, because I am, there's enough to do there. I like the element of getting away. I generally like the desert, getting to the desert anyway, going anywhere in the desert. But Vegas is fun because I like the resorts, I like the pools, I like the shows, I like doing all of that stuff. I'm not a huge gambler.
No.
But I appreciate the entertainment aspect you have in Vegas, plus some of the most amazing restaurants that you don't have access to here.
Yeah, the food in Vegas is really, really good.
So, and it's kind of like that perfect combination of like R&R, like you can relax and unwind, but still do some fun stuff. Like you don't have to be going 24/7. Like if you don't want to, you can balance it out quite a bit. So I like that aspect of it. But again, Vegas has to be small intervals. Like I can never live in Vegas or near Vegas. Like that would be too much sensory overload for me. It's good in small doses.
So I started watching Shogun on FX. Have you seen this show or watched
it? I'm aware
of
it. I haven't seen it, though.
The first 9.5 episodes are some of the best television I've ever seen. I would rank the first 9 episodes as equal to Game of Thrones.
Wow.
Just excellent. The acting's excellent. The writing's excellent. How it's shot. It just an absolute high-quality prestige TV show. Why can no TV show stick the landing on a season? Why is every show the finale is just completely unsatisfying? Because once again, leaves you completely hanging, kind of weird, and there's no second season.
You know, there's been articles about this, about how this is like the new trend now, that you have these finales that are just unfulfilling, and they just leave you like in a bad place. And I don't know why that's the case, or why that's just become standard, and why writers haven't become better at trying to.
I mean, these are prestige shows that cost hundreds of millions of dollars to produce, and then they just end with like a kind of like a thud.
Yeah.
I think with this one, they said there will be no second season of Shogun. Dude wrote 6 books. They all pick up the Japanese Revolution, I think, at a certain time.
Oh, okay.
So they would have to commit to making his next book, not a next series with Shogun, which I believe is a continuation of the story, but it's at a different time and place than the first one.
I'll have to put that on my radar to check out. I think the last, it was a miniseries, but I watched The Octopus Murders on Netflix.
Is that any good?
That was really good. I'd recommend it. I knew bits and pieces of the events that were chronicled in that show. There's a Kansas City connection for those of you Kansas Cityans. It's kind of interesting. I won't give it away. And I guess it does wrap everything up nicely, though. So yeah, it does leave you, it puts everything out there, and you're kind of left to try to put the pieces together and think, like is this, yeah, is it not? But it is worthwhile. It's done well. It's not too long. It's not too short. Sometimes some of those can drag on. This one really doesn't. Each episode provides you with more different facet, and then, you know, at the end, you kind of decide which side you're going to believe. I also want to catch, I haven't caught it yet, Apple's Franklin series on Ben Franklin with Michael Douglas.
That's excellent. I was thinking about the one where they're the Lincoln investigator. This is the one with Michael Douglas.
With Michael Douglas as Ben Franklin, yeah. So that's been out for a couple of weeks, but that's my next one to start.
He's a good Michael Douglas is a good, yeah, Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin was a massive playboy.
Oh, completely.
And Ben Franklin left his wife and children to die in America while he went and pursued all kinds of pursuits.
Exploits
in France
yeah, as ambassador. And he fathered dozens of kids by multiple women.
The only reason he got to the king, because he started sleeping with her, with his main mistress.
Yes.
And that's how he made the connection to the king of France.
Did you ever read, when I was in high school, we had to read a tract that he wrote. It's a very small written piece, so it's a tract. It's not like a novel or book. But it was a gentleman's guide to choosing a mistress. And it was Franklin's recommendation, like, if you're a young man and you need to choose a mistress, this is what you should do. This is how you should choose. You know, he actually said it's very interesting to read today, because again, this was written in the 1790s, but he basically said, you know, you should choose an older woman because they're more experienced and you don't have to deal with, you know, the immaturity. I mean, it's just very fascinating.
Ben knew what was at. Ben knew what he was talking about.
But the funny thing about Ben Franklin was, like, he was unapologetic. He didn't care what people thought. He just put it all out there. That's who he was.
After watching Shogun, where again, marriage is very much a transaction to facilitate a larger goal.
Well, as it has been through most of history.
And Ben saying, hey, there should be no expectation that you're loyal to your wife. That's ridiculous. I don't know. Maybe we'd be better if we just took more of this practical approach to marriage.
Yeah.
This isn't about unending, undying love. That could be part of it, but there's a lot of more practical things that go into it, just a day-to-day marriage.
Yeah, I mean, it would definitely lead to a lot less stress, right? Or people, like, you know, figuring out that they have to have perfect marriages or think a certain way or be a certain way.
Brandon, I got to tell you, as someone who's been married a long time, the most stressful thing I can think of is trying to form a relationship with another woman. That just sounds like the most god-awful thing. You have 30 years invested into this one. And that's awful.
Well, and my friends who have been divorced, I mean, especially like generationally, if you're someone who was married a couple decades ago and then now you're single and trying to date again, when the whole methodology of dating has changed, it's all app based. You can't just meet people in bars. Yeah. Like, it's very different today than it was then.
Those people have to be just getting slaughtered on the dating scene, I would think.
Yeah, a bit awkward.
That's our hour. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks for listening to 2 Men in the Middle. Make sure to give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our website at 2meninthemiddle.com. Drop us an email at 2meninthemiddle@gmail.com or tweet at us at 2meninthemiddle. We'll see you next week.